Welcome to Corporate Venturing Insider, the series where I sit down with top practitioners across the corporate venture capital ecosystem to uncover the best practices and golden nuggets they've gathered throughout their careers. This week, I'm excited to share a conversation from March 2025 with Gustavo Schwed, better known as Gus, a professor of private equity at NYU Stern and Princeton University. While Gus isn't your typical CVC guest, having only spent a brief early stint in corporate venture, he brings a wealth of insight from a distinguished career in private equity, including his role in one of the largest leveraged buyouts in European history. It was a pleasure having Gus on the show, and I learned a great deal from his perspective at the intersection of private equity, endowment investing, and education. Gus, could you start by telling us a bit about your journey and how you got to where you are today?
Yes, happy to do that. I started at a liberal arts college, getting my undergraduate degree, a place called Swarthmore College, which was a classic small liberal arts school. I was an economics major. There was no courses offered in business and accounting and finance and any of those things. When I got to be a senior, I started thinking about what to do with my life. I happened to have had a friend who would spend a summer working for an investment bank called Donaldson, Lufkin & Jenrette, which is no longer around, but was a very successful investment bank back then. And basically, he made me aware of the existence of these banks, and I started applying to them. I got a job at DLJ. And honestly, when I got that job, I was not 100% sure what DLJ actually did. But I knew that it was a job that attracted a lot of people that are focused on success and achievement. And so it caught my interest. I also knew that quantitative skills were important in that job, and that was a strength of mine. So just based on that, it seemed like a decent fit. So I went and became an analyst at DLJ for the standard two-year program. This is back in 1984. It's hard to imagine that even back then we had these programs, but it was very much like it is today. You spend 2 years there working around the clock. And after 2 years, I was pretty much fed up, I have to say, not because the work wasn't interesting, but because I think the lifestyle was unsustainable. I went to business school. I went to Stanford Business School. And while I was there, of course, I was exposed to the buy side because Stanford is in the middle of Silicon Valley and in the middle of the venture capital community. 3000 Sand Hill Road is a 10-minute drive. And so that was already a very well-established community. And I just thought, look, this is a way for me to apply some of the same skills that I picked up at DLJ, but do it in a way that fits my objectives better. It was very difficult to get a job in venture capital, as it still is, but I just leveraged my connections at DLJ to get a job at the Sprout Group, which was DLJ's venture capital unit. So it was a corporate venture capital group in a sense, although it was affiliated with an investment bank, not with a tech company. And Sprout was already a longstanding franchise that had a lot of success. It was very well run, had a very thorough investment process. I really learned how to think like an investor at Sprout. I really learned how to identify risks, how to balance risks against upsides. I also learned the hard way, the pain and agony that comes from making a bad investment. So I developed good skepticism, I guess, through that experience. And I did that for 6 years, started investing in medical device companies, not because I had a medical or even a science background. It's simply because there was a gap in coverage at the firm. Seemed like a place where I could make my own deals. You know, that's where the liberal arts education is actually very helpful. Being able to enter into this VC world, not know anything about medical products, and just learn it. And learn it to a point where I was quite proficient. So I did that for a while, like I said, for 6 years. I did feel after a while that my world was becoming pretty small. The world of medical devices is not a huge industry. And I just wasn't entirely comfortable with this idea of specializing so deeply so early in my career. It's like, at that age, how could I possibly know that this was the right place for me? And coincidentally, a very senior person at DLJ approached me at that time, knowing that I was born in Argentina and that I spoke Spanish, and asked whether I would join his merchant banking fund. That's what we used to call private equity. DLJ had a $1 billion private equity fund. At the time, this was in the early 90s, it was one of the largest in the world, actually. And he wanted me to join them and start a Latin American private equity business. So I did that. And a number of things happen at companies where things get restructured, somebody gets brought in, jobs get changed, et cetera, et cetera. And I found myself going from having responsibility to build this effort to now being asked to report to somebody. And I was not happy about that. Perhaps that was a bit immature on my part. And so I ended up joining Morgan Stanley to do the same thing. The guy that was running Morgan Stanley private equity back then, this was now in the mid-90s, was enthusiastic. He wanted to create a global business. And so he wanted to add Latin America to that global business. And he asked me to do that for him, which I did. So I got started with Morgan Stanley and I moved to Brazil because the traveling from New York to South America every other week was unsustainable. So I moved to Brazil, moved my whole family to São Paulo, relocated and started work building that business for Morgan Stanley in Latin America. And that took me till the year 2000. And what happened in Latin America in the late 90s, it was essentially a complete collapse because the strong currency regimes that Argentina and Brazil had introduced to try to bolster their currency became unsustainable. Basically, it started running out of control fiscal deficits, a lot of pressure on the currency. The U.S. dollar reserves were fleeing the country. And that eventually forced them to unpeg the currency from the dollar, and the currencies collapsed. And as a result, that destroyed a lot of businesses. And honestly, at that point, this is now the year 2000, I was pretty sure I'd get fired. It just seemed logical to me that here I was running a business that ran into this wall. And even though you could argue it wasn't my fault, people in that situation tend to get fired anyway. But my boss, who I think I had a very good relationship with and he thought highly of me, instead did call me and said he'd like me to shut down this Latin American effort. And he offered me the choice of coming to New York, joining the group in New York, or going to London and joining the group in London. And again, I made a decision based on what was less covered. So New York, lots of partners in New York, not that many in London. So I chose to move my family to London, joined Morgan Stanley Private Equity in London, became a partner and became the co-head of the European private equity business. So that was my big sort of bump up, I guess, and my first real exposure to larger leverage buyouts, which was what Morgan Stanley Private Equity was doing. And I was happy there working at Morgan Stanley Private Equity and, like I said, co-head of Europe. And by the way, at the same time, I was expected to keep running the emerging markets private equity business, which no longer included Latin America, but we have people in Hong Kong and in Singapore. And I became chairman of Morgan Stanley's emerging markets private equity business. So I wasn't active on the deal side, but I was supervising the people who were. So I had this dual mandate, and that was all fine until I'd say 2004, when the CEO of Morgan Stanley decided that the conflict between the buy side and the sell side was unsustainable at Morgan Stanley. In other words, every time that I had a deal I was interested in doing, I had to go through a conflict check. And every time I went through a conflict check, there was some investment banker who said, you can't do this deal because I want to represent a buyer or I want to represent the seller or something like that. And of course, it was an adjudication process for these conflicts. But because the probability of success in an investment banking mandate is always higher than the probability of you actually being the successful buyer in an auction environment, the bank more often decided in favor of the investment bankers. And I really felt like I was doing private equity with a hand tied behind my back. But then the CEO said, we don't want these sort of conflicts, so we're going to shut down private equity. We're not going to be in that business anymore. A decision that's since been reversed, by the way. But at the time, they made that decision. And so I found myself on the verge of being unemployed. And I started looking for a job and found a job at Providence Equity Partners, which is a global private equity firm. These days, I think they have about $50 billion of assets under management. And one of the deals that I did was the TDC deal, which is the telecom incumbent in Denmark. I was quite interested in buying a telephone company because they had a history of being state-owned monopolies. They weren't at that point, but that was their legacy. And so they were quite inefficiently run. And I thought there was opportunity really to create value in all of them, but most of them were too large for private equity. You can't really buy Deutsche Telekom if you're in private equity, it's just too big. So TDC, I teamed together with KKR, with Blackstone, with Permira and Apex. So it was a group of five private equity firms to buy this business. It was too large for any one of us. We bought TDC. That was the largest LBO in European history. It was about a $15 billion deal. Since then, obviously, there's been larger deals. But it was a kind of a groundbreaking deal because it took on a company that was of intense public interest. So the Danish political establishment, media establishment, and even general population was very focused on this deal. And they had, of course, a strong bias against the private equity industry. They considered us to be vultures. And they thought we'd just go in there and break it up, suck out all the value, leave the carcass behind, et cetera. So that was basically the narrative that was created by the Danish media. And honestly, I think we did not do a very good job of countering that narrative with our own narrative. But that deal was successful. That deal was done just before the financial crisis and was exited just after the financial crisis. So it was one of the few successes during that period of time. And at the end, we took the company public and we made a modestly good return. I wouldn't say it was spectacular, but I really think we left that company quite a bit stronger than it was when we got there, despite all the noise that went around that strategy. And then I did some other deals while I was there. And I kept working at Providence, London, until 2012, when I simply retired. I just decided 25 years in private equity, it's been a good career.
It's like 50 years in a normal company.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. And honestly, I retired with no notion of what I would do next. The only other activity I had then, which I still have, is I was on the board of my college, Swarthmore College, and I was on the investment committee, where we managed the endowment. And Swarthmore is a tiny school with a fairly large endowment. These days, I think we have about $800 million in private equity and venture capital. And so I led the part of the investment committee that evaluated and allocated capital to VC and private equity managers. And I'm still doing that. I'm still involved in that. So I'm still very much connected to what's happening in those worlds. But after about a year of not doing much, I was invited to do a guest lecture at NYU Stern by a professor who teaches a course in hedge funds. I just spoke about private equity. And based on that, they asked me to put a syllabus together. Then they asked me to teach a course as an adjunct professor, which means that you don't actually have a job there, but you get paid per course. And after about a year, given the popularity of the course and also the fact that they really did need coursework in private equity, they asked me to join full time. That would have been in 2014. And I'd been teaching there full time since then. So today I teach three courses. I teach a MBA level course in private equity, an undergraduate level course at NYU in private equity, and an undergraduate level course in entrepreneurial finance and private equity at Princeton.
Wow, this is quite a journey. And I like the fact that now you're teaching and helping students to think about how to become investors, which is part of what the podcast here is supposed to do. I want to ask a question about liberal art, because you make a point about that was important for someone who doesn't have PhD or a technical background to actually think the right way and to be good at learning. Could you double click on the value of the liberal art? Because we do have quite some audience who are not technical going into technology.
Right. Well, I'm a big believer in the liberal arts. The idea behind liberal arts, for those who might not be familiar, is rather than going to college or university and specializing very narrowly in something that has a vocational angle, you go to college and you take coursework in a variety of different areas. And honestly, a lot of the coursework is completely unrelated to jobs. And by doing that, you start strengthening really important skills. One is the critical thinking skills, which are applied to every course. It doesn't matter what topic it is. Secondly, communication skills. By that, I mean writing and speaking, both of which are really stressed at these liberal arts programs. And whereas I could have gone and gotten a finance degree, say at Wharton, and that would have been very useful to me in my first job. In fact, I would have known what DLJ did had I done that. And by the way, DLJ, until I arrived, hired almost only Wharton grads, because they wanted people who could hit the ground running. So what I found when I first got to DLJ was that I was definitely at a disadvantage against other analysts at the time. But within 6 months, I was at the very top of the class and had surpassed most of them. And I attribute a lot of that to already being conditioned to going into an area that is unfamiliar and figuring out very quickly how to break it down and how to get to the bottom of it and how to understand it. And so then I applied it again when I started my job in venture capital. I was never intimidated by going to a new area. So I attribute a lot of that to liberal arts education.
It's amazing. And it's a golden nugget, I think, for everyone who's thinking early about their career, not to plan too much. And actually, you preempted my questions because there are so many examples in your career where you went where you didn't know what it was going to look like. And you use words like going where it was a less covered choice. It was untested. Early 30s, starting a fund. You never did a fund before. So I think how do you get the courage? Because there's a level of courage to be able to go for something you have never done before, including in a new country you've never lived in before.
Yeah. Well, it never felt like courage to me when I was doing it. It felt like the right business decision or the right career decision. And by the way, it turned out not to always be the right career decision. So the Latin America experience, while it was a tremendous growth experience for me, in a sense, it was a failure because the entire region collapsed. To me, it just seemed like the natural thing to do. What I do tell my students come to me for advice all the time, is the broader your view, the more effective you are going to be in the deal business. In other words, if you have a very narrow view of the world and you're going to be less effective with other people, you're going to have lower emotional intelligence. You won't be able to sense as easily how emotions play a part in complex situations or even to read other people as well. And so what I tell them is one of the best growth experiences you can have is go live abroad for some period of time, even if it's just a couple of years. And so understanding that is really important in the investment business. So yeah, I really encourage young people to spend some time abroad and also to put themselves in uncomfortable situations. That's really where growth really takes place.
Which also gives you confidence to go to the next big challenge. And I would argue, you said it was a bad decision to go to Brazil, but I think it was a good decision, bad outcome type of profile. I like the way you frame it, which is don't be afraid to go into the uncomfortable. You also talked about the agony, that's the word you use, for bad investment. And talk about being uncomfortable, but here it's with your own actions, the consequence of your own actions. So can you share a bit more for the investors who are listening, how you handled that agony and how it made you a better investor moving forward?
Yes. Well, it's agony because it sucks up all your time and energy in a very negative way. And honestly, when an investment goes bad, my experience is it's really very difficult to turn it around. So you end up spending a lot of time and energy on it. And most of the time, that doesn't yield the results that you want it to yield. So I think actually what's very important is to see the inflection very early, because by the time the investment's distressed, it might be too late. So yeah, it's agony to have to go in there and fire a bunch of people and have very ugly confrontational disputes with the CEO. And perhaps the CEO doesn't like how they're getting fired and they threaten litigation. And there's a lot of bad things that come out, and it's emotionally very taxing. But of course, if you do your job, you have to try. You have to try to go in there and turn things around. And the critical thing is to learn what went wrong and try to avoid it in the future. The things that I've learned are, first of all, management team, or let's talk about CEOs. If I were to do a Venn diagram where every CEO is a bubble, I think the area of greatest overlap would be communication skills, because these are people who have to sell a vision internally and externally. But that also makes them very dangerous because they're very skilled at communicating. And I've learned the hard way how important it is to break through the facade and to really understand what makes this person tick, what they're good at and what they're not good at. And these are people who could be terrific visionary entrepreneurs, but when the company reaches a certain level of maturity and you should manage through use of key performance indicators and numbers and monitor cash flow and stuff like that, these people often can't make the transition or they're not interested in it. So that's an insight that's important too. It's don't get too impressed by the person's entrepreneurial success if you're thinking about backing them in something that's not strictly entrepreneurial. So that's an important lesson. The other is don't be intellectually dishonest with yourself, because it's very natural to feel a little bit of deal fever. You've been working on a deal, you want to close it. When you close a deal, you get pat on the back for closing a deal. But of course, it's a provisional patting on the back, because what really matters is what happens with the deal later. And so there's a saying about, what is it? It's act in haste and repent at leisure. That's what doing a bad deal is. You act in haste with the excitement of doing a deal, the momentum, the desire to make your mark. And then you can spend the next 5 years suffering as a result of the bad decisions you made. So don't ignore the warning signs, and you have to be super selective, and you can't just say, look, I'll just do 10 and two of them will be good and that's fine. It doesn't work that way. So you have to be very skeptical, very skeptical. You can't be so skeptical that you become cynical. If you're a cynic, then you're only good at seeing everything as can go bad, and then you'll never do a deal and you're not creating any value. So managing the balance between skepticism and optimism, that's tricky too, but you have to maintain both.
I want to double click on this, because I think that's so important, not to be dishonest, but also not to spin towards an investment committee. So when we make an investment proposal to our investment committee, we get a lot of quotes from TDK teams, our mothership, from investors, from big companies, and we put them all in. The negatives, the positives, the neutral, we don't try to spin anything and hand select. Can you share why you think, and I think it's both short-term but long-term, but why it's so important the investment committee gets to see the deal as it is?
Well, for the most obvious reason is at least a good decision-making, right? You're somehow manipulating, or as you said, spinning the information that you show an investment committee, but the deal may get approved for the wrong reason. And secondly, if the deal goes bad, then it's very different if your investment committee was fully supportive to begin with than if they were supportive only because you manipulated the information. It's hard for an investment committee to blame you for a deal that goes bad for reasons that were disclosed as actual risks in the deal, because all of you together made the decision to move forward. So I think it's good even to protect your own career, to be that honest.
Very nice. Now, I want to talk to something that will be a challenge for anyone investing. You talked about controlling the narrative and something you didn't do as much as you wish you had done. And there will be many times where we invest and something goes wrong, and there people will take the spotlight to tell their own narratives. What did you learn from your experience where all the Dutch may have had these narratives about private equity? What would you have done differently, and how would you think about controlling the narrative in a way that doesn't look like you're defending yourself, but you're putting forward the right positive narrative?
Right. So the deal that I was talking about, TDC, the Danish deal.
Oh, Danish, sorry.
The press was very negative throughout. And, you know, my view and the view of my co-investors was the less we say, the better. That anything we say, they're just going to attack. And then maybe we should just stay quiet. And we had a PR consultant who kept calling us saying, why don't you let me do my job? I never quite understood what he meant by that. It's like, well, what do you mean? You're our consultant. We consult you about what's happening in the press. And so what I learned from that is, whether directly or on background, you've got to be feeding the press with your version of the story. And it doesn't have to be defensive. It, in fact, can be maybe at TDC, we should have said, look at all the great things that are happening at TDC, and just keep pushing that. And it's true that there's a substantial part of the population that would never accept that. But it can influence the way people think about things. And these narratives aren't just a way to enhance your reputation. They have real direct impact on deal success. So you take a TDC, which is a consumer business. If people wake up in the morning and read in the newspapers how private equity is destroying TDC, at some point they're going to start canceling subscriptions and going with a competitor. And people have to feel good about the products they're consuming. So very important.
Yeah. In a way, controlling the narrative from the company point of view, not from the investor's point of view.
Yeah, I guess that's right. There was always an element of, we also wanted to improve the image of private equity in Europe, but Part of the feeding the press is that as well, because the otherwise there can be a political reaction against private equity. If the press convinces the voters that private equity is bad, the voters put pressure on the politicians, that leads to adverse legislation. So all of these are lessons that I learned throughout my life. I started when private equity was so small that nobody was really paying attention to it. And so we were very secretive. We thought, well, if we don't have to share what we're doing, why share what we're doing? And I think, I guess I missed a transition to when private equity became so large that it became a something of public interest. And therefore, it had to behave in a way that acknowledged that addressed the public concerns about the industry.
Yeah, you're becoming a very public stakeholder in the conversation. I want to shift gear and talk about VC firms and the fund size constraining what they can do because they have to deploy so much more. Same for endowment, where if the fund size is so big, you need to make different choices about where you allocate and to what type of VCs or private equity you invest. Now, there's something you said which I really like. You said your job in a way is to pick the best managers, and you even said the diamonds in the rough. Can you share how you think about picking these best managers? Because that's an art more than a science, I believe.
I guess by diamond in the rough, what I mean to say is not just do what everybody else is doing, not just back the next mega fund that's raising money. Consider small managers with a niche strategy and where perhaps they have less of a track record because it's a niche strategy. Like if VC came to us and said, look, good news, we're raising a new fund to chase AI, I'd say, well, I mean, how many of you are there out there chasing the same thing? Yep. So that wouldn't be very compelling. So things like that, just being a bit of a contrarian, not just going with a herd, understanding that having a relatively small fund is a disadvantage in some ways, but it's an advantage in others, and leveraging those advantages.
Well, Gus, I think it's a really good way to end this podcast. Thank you very much for sharing your journey, but also all the insights you collected along the way.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.